Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, January 4th, 2014, our first program in the new year, and I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Today we're going to be taking a look at some of the key economic developments from 2013 as a means to look ahead to this year. In his weekly webcast last night, when Lyndon LaRouche was asked about the prospects for the U.S. economy for the remainder of President Obama's second term, he stated bluntly that the U.S. will not survive a second term of Obama. And in fact, the question itself shows the problem, that even people who recognize the disaster that Obama has been accept the conditions which are leading to destruction and trying to find some way within these conditions to look for a ray of hope or for some way to survive. Now, in elaborating in his answer, what Mr. LaRouche did is focus on the growing divergence between the transatlantic world, which is in a downward death spiral, a collapse of physical economy, a growing debt crisis, new financial bubbles, and on the other side, the Eurasian world, where there has been an orientation towards science and technological development, major infrastructure programs, an effort to provide full-time productive jobs, and in fact, recognizing that not only is this the key to the future, but this was once the policy of our nation. Now, the danger in this is that the financial forces presiding over the collapse of the transatlantic, which are the forces which control President Obama, are committing to ending progress in Eurasia and are prepared to use terrorism and war to stop Russia, China, India, and their allies. And this has been a major part of what happened in 2013 with Obama's Asian pivot policy and with the targeting that's just accelerated in the second half of last year of Russia and President Putin. Now, this course toward war is not inevitable, as Lyndon LaRouche has presented an alternative direction, beginning with acting to bankrupt the Wall Street City of London speculators, which is a precondition to allow us to reverse the collapse, and then to combine that with collaborative efforts with the Eurasian powers, with the Go West program of the nuclear NAWAPA, the Bering Strait Tunnel, participation in the Trans-Siberian or the Silk Road rail process, and so on. So joining me today to discuss this is Paul Gallagher, who's one of the longtime featured writers on economics for the Executive Intelligence Review and a long time collaborator of Mr. LaRouche and of mine. So, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. Good to be on.
Well, there's so much to discuss, but at the outset, I'd like to take up something that people hear all the time, and most people don't believe it, but they keep hearing it, so they think maybe there's some truth, which is, I think we have to dispense with the illusions and fantasies coming from the administration and its allies, and also from most of the mainstream financial media, that we recovered from 2008, we're in a slow but steady economic recovery, and that we just have to stay the course and go with austerity to stop government spending to guarantee a continuing recovery. What is the actual state of the economy as opposed to this fantasy?
Well, I don't think too many people believe it, because it's been a recovery of certain statistics and a recovery of the levels of profit of major corporations and banks. That recovery actually started several years ago already, which recovery has not picked up any of the rest of the economy, where most people's employment and lives are concerned. So that, for example, the real unemployment rate, but leaving aside the real unemployment rate, the employment rate officially had not so many people dropped out of the labor force over the past 5 years since Obama came in, would be on the order of 12% now and not 7%. The labor force is really being hollowed out by the tremendous accumulation of both long-term unemployed people at the in their 40s, 50s, and even 60s, And also at the other extreme of the labor force in the young entrants, the large number of people estimated, not published by the government, but estimated by the most expert economists on this at about 3 to 3.5 million young people who have come of age to enter the labor force or completed their education to enter the labor force over the last 5 years, but have not entered it at all, or have very briefly entered and then dropped out again.
Well, Paul, when they do the official figures, which are now heading toward the 7% range, I mean, most people know that they leave out people who have exhausted their unemployment benefits. But I think the relevant stat that I've seen that, that shows a huge drop is in the actual percent of the eligible population that's working. What, isn't it down to something like 60%?
It's below that. It's about 58%. The ratio of what's called labor force participation,
right,
which is the portion of the essentially the people 16 to 65 years of age who are not institutionalized and therefore are potential entrants into the labor force, what portion of them are in it, that is working or looking for a job, that's down to about 63%. The ratio of the employed to the total population is down in the, below the middle 50s. And if you take those who are working full-time and are working full-time for an employer, not themselves, which as we know is a very, mm-hmm. it's a proliferating and very unstable situation of income, that percentage is down to about 43%. It hasn't, that hasn't been kept track of for a very long time, but is as low as it has ever been. So that, yes, these are all measures of the fact they have to be combined also with the fact that the share of the national product, which has gone to pay people for working, the employment, the pay for employment, that has declined to the lowest share of the national product that it has ever been, while the share which has gone to financial and non-financial corporate profits is at the highest that it has ever been. And this concentrates itself in the banking system, which is really the other thing that we need to get into when talking about a recovery, because to a tremendous extent, this talk about recovery is really wishful talk about the banking system supposedly having survived and not being about to crash again.
Well, I saw something the other night on CNBC where they had a panel talking about prospects for 2014. And what they were saying is that it's an unfortunate aspect of the last couple of years that people were spooked by the collapse in 2008, so they're not getting back into the stock market, so that the only people benefiting from this 26% run-up of the Dow Jones in 2013 were rich people and speculators. And then someone else said, yes, but that's the way it almost always is. That's why the rich are rich, because they're willing to take risks, whereas the average person is afraid of those risks. And no one brought up the fact that no one has disposable income anymore to buy stocks.
Well, my recent research and writing on this, there have been a lot, what I've called it is the financial crime of the century, that there have been a lot of crimes which have been revealed and a lot of very, very large fines which the banksters of the major U.S. and European banks have paid in the recent period, tens and tens of billions of dollars worth of fines.
The cost of doing business for them.
Cost of doing business for them. A lot of those securitization crimes have been exposed. In my view, there's a much bigger crime, which is really the financial crime of the century, mm-hmm. which has been committed by the central banks, led by the Federal Reserve, in cahoots with these, say, dozen in the U.S., dozen in the U.S. and Europe, on the order of 30 of the biggest banks, and also with the Obama administration, that this crime has been the direct blowing up of the size of the banks, which at that time were already too big to fail, and which 5 years later are 40% larger, and they are 40% larger entirely, and I mean entirely, 100%, because of the money that has been printed by the central bank. The Federal Reserve has dominated all the other central banks in doing this. Nearly $4 trillion now that has been printed by the central bank for the exclusive purpose of buying securities from these major banks and therefore increasing the size, their asset size.
So, Paul, just on that, because I saw your article on that. It was posted on LaRouche PAC, and people should take a look for that because it has a lot of very important aspects of this bailout. But out of the $4 trillion that's printed, how much of that gets beyond the 12 largest banks, the six in the U.S. and the corresponding European banks? It's almost entirely going to the largest banks, isn't it?
Yeah, the converse of what I said is true. It's not only the case that the entire huge growth by 40% of these biggest banks in 5 years has been due exclusively to the Fed's money printing, but it's also the case that all of the Fed's money printing has gone to these banks. I shouldn't have said $4 trillion. $4 trillion is the current size of the Fed's asset book, but it had a size of about $800 billion before the 2007-2008 crash. So it's really about $3.2 trillion that has been printed. And that has gone entirely into what they call the creation of excess reserves in the banking system. Now, in these major banks, it's been done by buying treasury securities and variously toxic mortgage securities from these banks. And when they use the term excess reserves, what they mean is bank reserves, cash bank reserves,
which they're not lending,
for which in their definition there is no demand in the economy, which it, by any sensible, sane definition, means that they are not lending it, yes. And that those banks, while they have become 40% larger in that 5 years, the proportion of their assets represented by loans in the same period has dropped from nearly 60% to now, for all of the big six banks in the U.S., biggest six banks in the U.S., between 30 and 40% only. So that they have not loaned this money out. They're lending. The lending of the entire U.S. banking system is down from 2008. But in the recent couple of years, the smaller community banks have increased their lending. The lending of these largest banks in the last 5 years is down by nearly $700 billion from what it was in 2008. So how can you put $3.2 trillion in, get $700 billion less in loans out of banks that are at the same time blown up by 40% in their total size? All that is doing is creating the bubbles, which are going to crash again. You look at
when you say they're growing in their current size, in other words, their obligations, their internal trading, their trading with other banks, of these toxic assets, that's where the bubble is taking place, right?
Yes, their assets have actually grown by 40%. For the top six banks in the U.S. are 40% larger by assets, and of course also by liabilities, and their deposits have grown by more than $2 trillion in the same period of time. And yet their lending is down $700 billion. So that tells you that these banks have ceased to be commercial banks, as we traditionally in America think of commercial banks as lending institutions for businesses and households. They are essentially wildly diversified security broker dealers and derivatives dealers who have a residual 30% to 35% lending business.
Paul, you know, this is, I just want to cut you off here for a second, because this is really gets right to the heart of the fraud of the Volcker Rule. In a sense, they're nothing but proprietary institutions. I mean, you're saying 60 to 70% of their lending is largely related to their own profits.
60 to 70%
assets.
Of their assets are the result of securities, purchase of securities, and also of the extension of credit for dealings in securities,
right,
including by their own thousands of subsidiaries that they each have. So, they're not commercial banks anymore until they are separated out by Glass-Steagall restoration and made protected commercial banks, and the rest is left to float and crash. Without that having been done, they are these other things which have been announced at the near the end of this year. Now finally we have a Volcker rule, supposedly sometime in 2015 or so, and we have new capital requirements sometime in 2018 or so. These things which have been announced are trivial compared to the dramatic change, derangement of these banks which has taken place, and the fact that they were able during 2013 as a whole in real pitched battle to prevent the passage of Glass-Steagall in any of the countries of the United States and Europe.
And so this is what you have defined as the real financial crime of the century.
Yes, this pumping up of these banks to be hopelessly bloated securities entities, which clearly are going to crash uncontrollably, or otherwise are going to become a good deal smaller under an orderly Glass-Steagall reorganization, and have really starved the economy of credit, so that it's going to be a fight to get credit flowing into the economy again when we do that. And that's the basis of the fact that there has not been a recovery that the vast majority of people can believe in, because their own condition has changed largely for the worse, and that's still going on, whether it has to do with their employment or their living conditions or where their income is going for shelter and so forth, or their medical care, all these things.
Well, you're listening to Paul Gallagher from the Executive Intelligence Review, who has been chronicling these developments for many years. And in particular, you can find some of the things Paul has written in the Executive Intelligence Review, and also occasionally it's posted on LaRouchePack.com. This is the LaRouche Show. It's January 4th, 2014. And we're taking a look at the real state of the economy. Now, Paul, one of the distinctions that Lyndon LaRouche has always made is between a monetary system and a productive physical economy. And what you're describing is sort of a monetary system that's gone out of control, that virtually every aspect of trade and finance of the monetary system is based on trying to keep the monetary system liquid, even though as I think a few economists have pointed out, there's an important difference between liquidity and solvency.
Right.
Most of these large banks are essentially insolvent.
That's true. at the same time as they have been made by the Fed to be extremely liquid, and to have these vast amounts of liquidity both redeposited back at the Federal Reserve, that's where the excess reserves wind up. They're deposited back at the Federal Reserve, and Federal Reserve pays a little bit of interest for them, but also they go into what's called the shadow banking market, or the sometimes more precisely the repo or repurchase market, at which there is very, very short-term securities-based and derivatives-based lending that goes on among banks and between banks and other kinds of financial institutions, from hedge funds to special purpose vehicles, money market funds, and so forth. And this is what is really feared most by any sane regulator in the United States or Europe today, is that these very short-term lending markets, repo and related lending markets, are completely unregulated, out of control, and could break up at any time.
They're much more extended than it was with Lehman Brothers and the other investment banks in September 2008.
Yeah, you had this editorial, op editorial, I guess it was, by Gordon Brown, the former, just 3 weeks ago, December 16th, in the New York Times. He was the former Prime Minister and Chancellor of the UK, of course. And his thing was called Stumbling Towards the Next Crash. One of the things that he pointed out there, in addition to some of the things that I've just been talking about in terms of the change in the condition and derangement of the banks, is that the shadow banking system's assets are considerably larger now than they were when they blew up in 2008. They were then estimated in the range of $58, $59 trillion in this non-bank or shadow bank financial markets, and now $71 trillion in the same markets. And he, like everybody else writing about the subject, says this is where the real danger is, because this is completely unregulated. And this is what really blew up in 2008.
Now, we also, I just am curious if you know to what extent this flow of funds from the Fed to these banks ends up in some way in the stock market bubble, because we've seen a year in which there have been 52 or 53 times a record was set for the closing on the, of the Dow Jones. It's over 16,000 right now. I mean, this is part of the overall speculation, but to what extent is this related to the quantitative easing in the Fed's policy?
I haven't really studied that. I have seen, so I'm not certainly not going to try to describe it in any detail. I have seen graphs which make a very pretty picture of the stock market tracking the increase in so-called Federal Reserve reserve asset creation almost exactly over the last 5 years. So it's clear that's where it's going.
Well, and then the other area of real expansion has been the initial public offerings, the leverage buyouts, where, I mean, just one of the most obvious ones is here you have Twitter, which has never made a profit, which doesn't produce anything, and was almost a $2 billion initial public offering.
Yes, and also new bubbles of securitization. For example, subprime auto loans, something which didn't exist at the time the crash occurred 5 to 6 years ago.
I understand. Also, rental derivatives.
Securitized home rent.
Yeah.
I don't know if sure that did not exist 5 years ago, but it's now a bubble that's growing very rapidly. But also those which did exist and clearly blew up at that time, for example, the junk bond markets, are now bigger. Those are bigger bubbles now than they were 5 years ago. This, you look at these banks, which are expanding so rapidly, reducing their lending, having this money pumped into them from the Fed continuously, and this is going to go on, clearly, at least for another year.
Well, that's my next question, because I guess tomorrow, or Monday rather, Janet Yellen's nomination comes up, and it's expected she'll be passed, confirmed as the new chairman of the Federal Reserve. But on this whole question of taper to not taper, to me that's become somewhat of a bogus issue, because they're sort of locked in, aren't they, to the continued expansion of the quantitative easing?
Well, they're definitely...
Or shifting it in different ways.
Yeah, they're definitely locked into the quantitative easing. And, you know, their whole calculus now is how fast will interest rates rise when they see that the rise begin to accelerate. I think tapering will stop. But it also, tapering is not all there is. They have introduced within the last year quantitative easing for non-banks as well, which the Fed calls its reverse repo program, which it began on a test basis and has been expanding, whereby they make the same kind of purchases as they've been making from the banks. They make the same kind of purchases from anything from hedge funds to money market funds. And that has been growing. So that's not tapering.
Mm-hmm. Now, also this in the last year, we saw the ruling in Detroit, which I guess is still up in the air in the courts, but was a form of the bail-in. And I wonder if you could just discuss where things stand at this point in terms of the variety of bail-ins, because it's not simply a question of stealing deposited funds in banks, but it's become a fairly widespread approach to redefining the relationship between depositors and bankers, or pension funds and the people who are their pensioners. This is really, I think, a much bigger issue than most people realize.
Well, I think you have to really have been looking at the the policy discussions, if they deserve such an exalted name, among bank regulators in Europe and officials of the European Commission and so forth over the last several years, and between them and the International Monetary Fund, on the question of how the hell are they going to keep the European banks' insolvency from breaking out in a general collapse. Those banks are in far worse shape than the US-based banks. And for example, just to give an example, the biggest of them, Deutsche Bank, the biggest derivatives bank in the world, has on its asset book 11% loans, not 30 to 35%, but 11%. This is not a bank at all. It's a very highly diversified set of non-banks, all under a bank holding company by the thousands. And these banks are really full of bad debt. And at that level, the kind of bail-in that's being discussed is, and it's come from the IMF twice now, and the first time it had to be pulled back publicly, is proposals to just take money from accounts globally to somehow enact, which they imagine they can do within the European Union, somehow enact simultaneously a tax on all bank accounts in all countries. The order of 6 to 10% was suggested, in order to bail in everybody at once and use that to reduce the debt burden of the countries involved, that is the sovereign debt burden of the countries involved, which itself arose from bailing out the bad debt of their banks, and the bad debt of their banks is still there.
But there's a kind of a fraud here, because even one of the reasons they're talking about bail-ins is the widespread opposition to bailouts, to having central banks just give money to what are essentially bankrupt financial institutions. So they're now saying these bankrupt financial institutions can steal from their own depositors. But even if you continue bailouts and bail-ins, the assumption is that you're going to be limited to having to deal with one or two institutions at a time that you can isolate and put through some kind of FDIC-type bankruptcy reorganization. But Thomas Honig has pointed out that because of the integrated nature of the banking system, this can't happen. It's going to be across the board, and there's not enough money, is there, to do bail-ins to protect these institutions?
Well, no. I mean, as you say, Thomas Honig, who is a FDIC vice chairman who supports Glass-Steagall publicly and aggressively, has said this in so many words, has said it clearly and publicly, that the bailout, the so-called bail-in, is not going to work, because it isn't going to be a single event, as he says, an idiosyncratic event, where one big bank is in trouble for some reason, but rather a systemic event. And as he put it the last time I asked him about it, in that situation, no Treasury Secretary is going to say, let them all fail. So you're going to have a bailout again. But the interesting thing is that Federal Reserve governors in some numbers who do not support Glass-Steagall, in fact, led by William Dudley, the New York Federal Reserve governor, whose opposition and to killing Glass-Steagall goes back to the 1980s. He was in on the ground floor of getting rid of Glass-Steagall. even he and other governors of the Federal Reserve, who are explaining and promoting the so-called bail-in as the alternative to the bailout, do so in the most lukewarm terms and indicate clearly that they don't expect it to work and that they really don't want to have to try to use it. And that the only way it may work is that the bail-in provision of the Dodd-Frank Act comes with a very large credit line from the U.S. Treasury, that is the taxpayers, to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which credit line the FDIC can use in supposedly liquidating or resolving in an orderly manner a very large bank, even one very large bank. And that makes the bail-in a bailout. They may say that, well, this will be paid back by a tax on all the, or a premium on all the banks over the next 10 years, but that doesn't change the fact that when it happens, it's going to be a large bailout, except not done by the Treasury or Fed, but done by the FDIC in this case.
Well, and while they're talking about these things, they're totally connected to the push for literally destroying governments under austerity regimes. That this is we see it in case of the IMF, EU, ECB, the Troika policies that are destroying Greece or Portugal or Spain. But we also see it in the insane budget debates going on in the United States. So in terms of the way it's looking now, obviously this year, if we don't get Obama out, we're going to see a kind of strange alliance between Obama and the Wall Street Democrats with the Wall Street Republicans pushing for dismantling whole sections of the federal government. I mean, but that how do they make money from that?
Well, you brought up Detroit. And this is obviously a very fundamental case of complete destruction of the physical economy of a region which used to be the most productive region in the entire economy. It's a process that's been going on for a long time, but now we see where bail-in is being applied to that in a potentially genocidal way. And everybody knows that it could be the national precedent for public workers. Well, the public workers of the United States certainly know that their pensions are not into a recovery, rather that their pensions are very much in doubt across the board, and they see it in what's happened in Detroit. And there, the process was that what the people like Mr. Dudley of the Federal Reserve call qualified financial contracts, which is a fancy term for derivatives contract, financial derivatives, that qualified financial contracts have priority in a bankruptcy over everything else. And in a potential liquidation of a bank under a so-called bail-in, they still have priority over everything else. And they will be used to seize the assets of something that's failing before any orderly process can take place. Now, in Detroit, we've actually seen that happening.
Right.
But there's a fight against it. We've seen it in the sense that the dominant debt, which is driving Detroit under, is a so-called interest rate swap derivatives contract, a qualified financial contract of UBS and the Merrill Lynch division of Bank of America, and that they were very close to just swiping $230 million from a city whose total annual revenue isn't much over $1 billion,
right,
and which is in the process of laying everybody off, stealing everybody's pension, and so forth. And they were very close to just swiping that. They were going to swipe it this past October, or at the latest this coming March, because they had that qualified financial contract. They were going to bail in all of these pensioners and employees of the city of Detroit, take some of their wages, take some of their pension, take some of their health, take their health benefits pretty generally away from them. Now the judge there, there's a battle on, in which Bill Roberts, our leader there, and others have been leading forces. There's a battle on, and the bankruptcy judge has kicked over the bucket a little bit with the size of this payout, so that now it's reportedly he's insisting that it be down to no more than 165 million instead of 230 million. But the hearings are still going on. The damn thing is illegal to begin with, and so you know, the bail-in may get a real kick in the teeth there, and that would be obviously good.
I think as we're looking at the situation with banking, and we're talking with Paul Gallagher from the Executive Intelligence Review, the thing that becomes quite obvious is why it is they're so scared of the motion toward Glass-Steagall. And you mentioned the pitched battle in 2013. For those of our listeners who are maybe new, why don't you give them a little report on how we ended up going head-to-head with the American Banking Association and Jamie Dimon himself on Glass-Steagall, and the importance of this for legislative fights in the coming weeks?
Well, the essence of it is that around the beginning of 2013, the major banks in the U.S. and their representatives in the American Banking Association and in the International Swaps and Derivatives Association and so forth, they realized that we had, by we, I say, a mobilization that was really for Glass-Steagall restoration that was really catalyzed by LaRouche PAC and by EIR, that we had flanked them, and that the prospect of Glass-Steagall being restored in Congress, which they were sure was written off, was actually becoming a real one. And this was because we intensified roughly in August, September of 2012, we had really intensified our work, both at the state level with all sorts of elected officials and legislatures at the state level, 25 of them where 25 of the states had resolutions, some of them passed, but also at the congressional level and among constituencies. We had really kicked it up a notch, and it was becoming a real possibility. The banks went into a counter mobilization, which involved a lot of propaganda, and behind the scenes, a lot of threats, which by the end of the year were not behind the scenes anymore. They were making these threats openly and directly, particularly to state elected officials at their national conferences. And they were making them to members of Congress who told us, and I myself have been told about them by two different members of Congress, the same threats to them that whereas the Glass-Steagall sponsorship had already reached nearly 80 in the House and 11 in the Senate by the middle of the year, that any further additions to that, any further state or elected officials or congressmen who stepped up to sponsor would be hit by financial warfare in their districts or in their states if they were senators immediately and directly, and that would include eliminating as many jobs in that district or in that state as the banks could do as a penalty against putting your name behind Glass-Steagall. Members of Congress who were already sponsors and who were talking to other members about sponsoring ran into this repeatedly.
Well, Paul, in the short term, it did seem to be successful in terms of blunting our efforts, although with the reports that came out on the Volcker rule, it seemed again to start the debate that all the post-2008 reforms amount to nothing. And I think this is where, in the next weeks, when the Congress comes back in session and these kinds of crises continue to blow up, this actually is an excellent opportunity for us to get this through. Would that be your assessment?
Yeah, I think in the same way that the catastrophes that people have seen embedded in Obamacare have restarted the pretty much stalled out movement for a single payer, universal single payer healthcare, mm-hmm. that is Medicare for all, these attempts to tamp to finally quash the thing down at the end of the year, after they had slowed the momentum a great deal in Congress by the combination of these threats and a great deal of propaganda, they tried to tamp it down with the regulators all coming out with the Volcker Rule and supposedly coming out with a new capital requirement for the larger banks. But they were kind of like firecrackers that only the sparks only went up 3 or 4 feet, and then they died out. And so the people who were all had all gathered around to watch these new regulations come into being saw pretty much that they were fraudulent. The new capital requirements for the major banks, not only is that scheduled for 2018, but actually that has ground to a halt again as of now. Some of the U.S. regulators are simply not letting it go through, and neither are the European regulators. And as far as the Volcker Rule is concerned, suffice it to say that any regulation which is aimed at controlling only the behavior, and in a very, very complicated way full of loopholes to begin with, but only the behavior of the commercial bank unit in a holding company which has thousands of subsidiary units, does not exactly stop the wild security speculation that's going on. So there have been many exposés of the failure of that, and the mm-hmm. fact that it doesn't go into effect for at least 2 years and perhaps four. So that, I think, combined with the internationalization of this, the crossfire between the United States and Europe, where there have also been some real close calls. A kind of delayed, 3 year delayed Glass-Steagall law came within 9 votes of passing in the House of Lords in Great Britain, and was supported by a majority in the House of Commons if it had passed. The Belgian government was stopped right on the edge of implementing a Glass-Steagall law by, this was just last month, by a real mobilization of the entire European Commission bureaucracy against them, threats from all the major banks to leave Belgium to immediately cause mass unemployment here and there and so on. They just barely stopped the Belgian government itself from advancing a Glass-Steagall law, which would have been the real thing. So earlier in Switzerland, it passed the lower house, but not was rejected by the government.
Well, Paul, you do a lot of work in the Congress, and including with people who are Glass-Steagall supporters. What are they saying of the prospects for this year? What's it going to take to get this actually into a committee, through a committee, and onto the floor?
Well, most of them think, including some of them that are organizing hard for it, think that it will be passed immediately upon the signs of another crash, or upon the emergence of another London whale major bank loss, like the JP Morgan Chase London whale losses. In other words, they are talking to their colleagues about Glass-Steagall and essentially waiting for the next shoe to drop. And this is the situation that we think we can break through by a combination of the failure of the Volcker Rule, which is one similar situation, and also we plan to have a lot more personal crossfire across the Atlantic in the immediate coming months between leading exponents of Glass-Steagall laws in Europe and sponsors of it here. We've already done some of that toward the end of 2013 with elected officials from Germany and then from Greece meeting with members of Congress. That resulted in 2 additional sponsors in the U.S. Congress, which were virtually the only 2 additional sponsors in the last last couple of months of the year, and we're going to accelerate that.
Now, you brought up Obamacare. We were talking before about bailouts of other kinds of financial institutions. Very few people think about the insurance companies as financial institutions, but just remember AIG, Prudential, they're right at the heart of the funding of that goes into the so-called shadow banking and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've done some writing also on Obamacare and I think on the insurance companies. This is another big bailout, isn't it? Because it's not a health insurance policy. It's a law to force you to buy private insurance.
Well, the way, I think the broadest way to characterize this Obamacare law and its operation and those things which have been brought into action along with it, particularly the actions by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the so-called CMS, in cutting off many tests and essentially withdrawing Medicare insurance from procedures and tests and visits and so on. Obamacare has essentially been a war on Medicare in that it was passed instead of, just as Dodd-Frank was passed to block Glass-Steagall, it was passed instead of Medicare for All, universal single-payer health insurance, which would have and will be far more efficient and far more safe as a health insurance measure than anything that's going on now. And it was funded initially by cutting Medicare to the tune of about $550 billion over a decade, and is going to be further funded by including all the subsidies that are going to the insurance companies, is going to be further funded by continual reductions in what is possible under Medicare. To give you an example, there has been an 11% drop in the 3 years since Obamacare was passed in the total use of healthcare by seniors, according to studies by the Kaiser Foundation and others. This drop is a combination of the effects of the collapse, the economic collapse, making people postpone essential medical care and prescriptions and so forth, and also the workings of Obamacare in cutting off prescriptions, visits, certain procedures, certain tests. And at the same time, the insurance companies are receiving huge subsidies and are in addition protected if Obamacare really goes completely wrong and the healthy people never sign up and the insurance companies don't make out a bundle out of it. They then are protected by the so-called risk corridor insurance, which will reimburse them from 80% of what they think they should have gotten as of the middle of this decade. So you're going to see a situation if Obamacare really went through and was implemented as designed, where the insurance companies would become the primary providers of health care in the United States, where the insurance companies will be in control of the majority of health professionals who would be working for entities which those insurance companies own, hospital groups. And
Republicans keep warning that it's a government takeover.
It's an insurance company takeover, and it's acting in particular against the most effective medical care insurance program we have ever had, which is Medicare. It has never covered everything. It has always had certain areas which it didn't go into. But on the essentials of healthcare, it has delivered more and delivered them much more efficiently for lower premiums than any other form of healthcare, and it has been the target. You're going to see much more under Obamacare.
And that includes by Obama himself and the Harry Reid and the Democrats who are working with him.
Yeah, and they sometimes make big political issues out of these after they lose a fight, and then they stage a big political fight to try to claim that the Republicans we're solely responsible for something. But you know, let me put it this way: as of the middle of the past year, 2013, the main concern of Democrats in the Congress, which we got directly from them, directly and indirectly from them, was the coming failure of Obamacare, and that that was going to wipe them out in the 2014 congressional elections. They still have that tremendous fear, which causes them to try to, as a reaction formation, to try to support Obamacare publicly, support Obama on it publicly, and so forth, because they really think that of the issues for which he is potentially impeachable, this is the one which could wipe them all out, because it is clearly an austerity program against medicine and an austerity program against medical care and for these insurance companies. And it's opposed in a way which few things of this type have ever been opposed by the broad public. So that's the situation that they face. And you know, LaRouche calls repeatedly for impeaching him right away, and this is the one thing that his quote-unquote supporters, who don't really support him very much, in the Democratic Party have been most afraid of for nearly a year now.
Well, and this is one of the important reasons that we are running Keisha Rogers for the U.S. Senate, to actually make sure that this is what the elections will be decided on, these kinds of real issues, as opposed to all the silly so-called social issues or the phony economic issues like the debt ceiling or the budget. But I think that, you know, if you have any sense of this from the Congress, you know, the anger in the population is not calming down. There's anger about the rollout of Obamacare. There's anger about the bailouts. There's anger about the huge profits made by Wall Street and the collapse of the so-called Main Street, the physical economy. To what extent, Paul, do you have a sense in Congress that among the Democrats and also some of the sane Republicans that they're going to have to change something in 2014?
Well, I think that comes I think that comes to a great extent from our discussions with them, that they would have any clear idea of what they're going to change. And those of them who have gotten on the right track, as for example with Glass-Steagall and with some proposals for national infrastructure banks, although most of them are not very serious, most of them are rather looking at what could knock them off, what could destroy them politically, rather than what it is that they should do in 2013. That's unfortunate. That's, I think, why LaRouche has given such a great importance and support to Keisha Rogers' campaign for Senate in Texas. It's a big state. She's already an established political figure and real someone who has shown that you can really win by going against Obama and the establishment in that state. And she's going to campaign and is campaigning on the major things that have to be done, not against, but what you have to do, the legacy of Kennedy, the legacy of major infrastructure missions and science missions for this country, the need to get rid of, to get Obama out of office. You know, those actions are going to be represented by her campaign. But I'm just telling you bluntly, there's a great deal of fear among members of Congress, both parties, particularly Democrats, about what can really destroy them in what Obama is doing and has been doing. But in terms of what are the great things they should do in 2013, there are very, very few of them that are thinking along those lines. And it's mainly those who have started on the Glass, you know, who are really active public campaigners for Glass-Steagall and know that the United States hasn't invested in its infrastructure for more than half a century since Kennedy, and since Kennedy was killed. And they need to find a way to do that.
Well, and Paul, one of the things I'd like you to talk about, because you have also a great deal of experience in the past with the Fusion Energy Foundation working on this whole question of the relationship between bringing online new technologies that have higher energy flux densities, how that increases the actual so-called profit, or how it is that you can produce more than you can consume, which is really what you have to do to get out of a budget crisis. It seems as though there's almost nobody in Washington that has this conception, because they all think either you have to increase taxes or cut spending. But the lessons of NASA in the Kennedy era, or what happened slightly longer ago, Franklin Roosevelt's early part of the New Deal, that seems to be lost on this generation of congressmen. Are there some people who can discuss these things intelligently?
Yeah, there are. I mean, the problem you're indicating is that the dominant idea, unfortunately, is that productivity results from investment and innovation in private industry, and that the purpose of investment and infrastructure spending by the government is to create employment, which is a crazy idea. You only have to go back to Kennedy and the way he spoke about the one major mission after another for the country to realize that what the government does in directing national credit to the most productive, the biggest changes in productivity that can be achieved by new infrastructure, that is what drives the economy into real growth, and it's also what drives the human race towards the future that it's intended for, and the countries to contribute to that. What the private sector does is obviously very useful, inventive, and so on, but without the investment in productivity through new technologies and new breakthroughs being implemented in the infrastructure areas of the economy, these leaps simply don't take place. That's why it was the space program, a fundamental transportation infrastructure program of the broadest sort ever conceived, and before that the innovations in atomic energy, entirely the responsibility of government research and investment, which completely changed the potentials of medical science, of science in general, of energy production, and led us to the point where we could think about thermonuclear fusion energy for the future. Those infrastructure transformations, new platforms, LaRouche calls them, that's where productivity and growth in economies really come from. They don't come from private industrial tinkering without that kind of leadership. So the debate or discussion with the advocates of infrastructure banks and infrastructure spending in the Congress mainly has to do with the question of that quality, that infrastructure is not anything you choose to spend money on to employ people. It's not synonymous with public works in mm-hmm. that sense. It has to be science driver infrastructure, productivity driver infrastructure, and that's what it was with Kennedy, that's what it was with Roosevelt before him, that's what it was with Lincoln, mm-hmm. In a way which drove the United States economy for the whole last 30 years of the 19th century.
Well, Paul, we're down to about the last minute, so I think since we are talking to people who in many cases are LaRouche activists, that they should not look at the last couple of months' fight with the ABA as the American Banking Association as a losing battle, but just moving into a new phase. I would assume that what you and the others who meet with the congressmen are looking for is a new level of upsurge from the population and fight for Glass-Steagall to really impact the Congress.
Yeah, because there were a lot of additional congressmen who came onto board with Glass-Steagall during the last year, and that was almost exclusively because of that kind of constituency pressure, and a lot of it coming through their state legislators in their respective states and districts. So that has to be accelerated again, and as I say, we're going to try to combine it with cross-firing from leading forces that are in various countries of Europe that have been fighting for the same thing.
Well, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk a little bit about the developments in Ukraine and Russia, but you can pick that up on the website. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And this has been the LaRouche Show. We will be back next week at 3 p.m. Eastern on Saturday, and you can go to the archives on LaRouchePub.com on the Executive Intelligence Review website. Thanks for joining us.